Jeremiah chapter 7. This begins a new, you might call it a new section in Jeremiah. Probably going through chapter 10. It's very difficult to outline Jeremiah, actually, and even to determine when the things that are written were actually preached by Jeremiah. There are those who have tried to put it together, and it's not an easy thing to do, and I haven't even attempted to do that. But there is a shift in the approach to the words that Jeremiah uses here. He has used a great deal of poetic language in the previous messages here. It's more of what we would call prose, direct language. And so there's similarity in the message, but also there's a shift of emphasis as well. The message that makes up at least the first 15 verses of this chapter, I'm going to read the chapter in a moment, is called Jeremiah's Temple Sermon. That is, that's what folks call it because it was preached at the gate of the temple. A similar message is found over in chapter 26. It may be the same message. It may be preached at different times, but the similarity of the two make it seem like it is the same message that's put twice in Jeremiah. In Jeremiah 7, it is put here to emphasize the content of the message, and over in chapter 26 to emphasize the reaction to the message, which we'll not get to today, but the reaction of the message was wasn't very pleasant. They wanted to kill him after he preached this message. We won't get to that today, but we will eventually in chapter 26. It was probably preached, as at least if it was the same message as that is recorded in chapter 26, it was preached in the time of Jehoiakim, which is would be the great-grandson, two kings removed from Josiah, the one that reigned after him, only was a brief period of months, I think 3 months, and he was taken down into Egypt. And then this one was, Jehoiakim was put into place, and he eventually was taken into Babylon. 11 years he reigned as king. 609 is when he began to reign as king. That's probably when this message was preached. It was preached at the gate of the temple, the entrance point to the courtyard to the temple. It was probably preached on a festival day when the nation gathered at Jerusalem, when those from all over the nation, the cities around the southern kingdom, came to Jerusalem. Remember, the temple and the worship had been reinstituted under Josiah's reign. And so folks came to Jerusalem and they were making their way into the temple. It was a bold call for reform. A bold call for repentance. A bold call to amend their ways. The word of the Lord came to Jeremiah from the Lord saying, "Stand in the gate of the Lord's house and proclaim there this word and say, hear the word of the Lord, all ye of Judah, that enter in at these gates to worship the Lord. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, amend your ways and your doings, and I will cause you to dwell in this place. Trust ye not in lying words, saying, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord. For if ye truly amend your ways and your doings, if ye truly execute judgment between a man and his neighbor, if ye oppress not the stranger," maybe similar to our immigrants, "the fatherless," not just orphans, "the fatherless, and the widow, the helpless, and shed not innocent blood in this place," probably referring to judicial judgments that were being passed down, reminds me a little bit of Massachusetts in days gone by in the 1600s, when some who we would consider our forefathers were beaten to a pulp. Why? Because they dared immerse those who were converted. Because they dared gathering on the Lord's Day outside of the established church of Massachusetts. That's in this country in the 1600s. One of the religious leaders of the Puritan Calvinists actually said of one person that was driven out of the land, said he should have been put to death because of his viewpoints on the Scriptures. Brethren, that is shedding of innocent blood. And it's happened in this country. Those who are placed in positions of power, making unjust judgments of others. Neither walk after other gods to your hurt. Then will I cause you to dwell in this place, in the land that I gave to your fathers, forever and ever. Thankfully, in this country, there have been some things that have been dealt with, and dealt with justly and made corrections. One of them that stands out is the institution of slavery, which in my opinion was a horrible institution as it was carried out in this country. Oh, there were those who treated their slaves very well, and history records that, but the institution itself was an ungodly institution. And this country, I think, probably still suffers because of it. You say, well, that's another story. Well, it kind of fits into what Jeremiah is dealing with right here, I think. Unjust judgments, unjust dealings in a land. Behold, ye trust in lying words that cannot profit. Will ye still steal, murder, and commit adultery, and swear falsely, and burn incense unto Baal, and walk after other gods whom ye know not? And come and stand before me in this house. Remember, Jeremiah's preaching this as they come in. Which is called by my name, and say, we are delivered to do all these abominations. Is this house which is called by my name become a den of robbers in your eyes? Behold, even I have seen it, saith the Lord. But go ye now unto my place which was in Shiloh, where I set my name at the first. And see what I did to it for the wickedness of my people Israel. And now, because ye have done all these works, saith the Lord, and I spake unto you, rising up early and speaking, but ye heard not. Charles said in the last message that the one who stands in the pulpit, if he's delivering God's message, stands as God's spokesman. Charles, there's a verse for you right there. The Lord is saying, he is speaking, and yet he said, I rose up early, and yet it was the prophets who did the rising up, and the prophets who did the speaking in God's stead. And I called you, God says, but ye answered not. Therefore will I do unto this house which is called by my name, wherein ye trust, and unto the place which I gave to you and to your fathers, as I have done to Shiloh. And I will cast you out of my sight, as I have cast out all your brethren, even the whole seed of Ephraim, the northern kingdom. Therefore pray not thou for this people, neither lift up nor a cry nor prayer for them, neither make intercession to me, for I will not hear thee. Seest thou not what they do in the cities of Judah and in the streets of Jerusalem? The children gather wood, and the fathers kindle the fire, and the women knead their dough to make cakes to the Queen of Heaven, and to pour out drink offerings unto other gods, that they may provoke me to anger. Do they provoke me to anger, saith the Lord? Do they not provoke themselves to the confusion of their own faces? Therefore thus saith the Lord God, behold, mine anger and my fury shall be poured out upon this place, upon man and upon beast, and upon the trees of the field and upon the fruit of the ground, and it shall burn and it shall not be quenched. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, put your burnt offerings unto your sacrifices and eat flesh. In other words, go ahead and barbecue it for yourself. It ain't doing me any good. and it ain't doing you any good in relationship to me. For I spake not unto your fathers, nor commanded them in the day that I brought them out of the land of Egypt concerning burnt offerings or sacrifices, but this thing commanded I them, saying, obey my voice, and I will be your God, and ye shall be my people. And walk ye in all the ways that I have commanded you, that it may be well unto you. But they hearken not, nor incline their ear, but walked in the counsels and in the imagination of their evil heart, and went backward and not forward. Since the day that your fathers came forth out of the land of Egypt unto this day, I have even sent unto you all my servants the prophets, daily rising up early and sending them. Yet they hearkened not unto me, nor inclined their ear, but hardened their neck. They did worse than their fathers. Therefore thou shalt speak all these words unto them, but they will not hearken to thee. Thou shalt also call unto them, but they will not answer thee. But thou shalt say unto them, this is a nation that obeyeth not the voice of the Lord their God, nor receiveth correction. Truth is perished, and is cut off from their mouth. Cut off thine hair, O Jerusalem, and cast it away, and take up a lamentation on high places. For the Lord hath rejected and forsaken the generation of his wrath. For the children of Judah have done evil in my sight, saith the Lord. They have set their abominations in the house which is called by my name to pollute it. And they have built the high places of Tophet, which is in the valley of the son of Hinnom, to burn their sons and their daughters in the fire, which I commanded them not. Neither came it into my heart. Therefore, behold, the days come, saith the Lord, that it shall no more be called Tophet, nor the valley of the son of Hinnom, but the valley of slaughter. For they shall bury in Tophet till there be no place. They're going to run out of space to bury their dead. And the carcasses of this people shall be meat for the fowls of the heaven, and for the beasts of the earth, and none shall fray them away. You won't be able to shoo the birds away. There will be none to do that. Then will I cause to cease from the cities of Judah and from the streets of Jerusalem the voice of mirth and the voice of gladness and the voice of the bridegroom and the voice of the bride. The land shall be desolate. This chapter exposes the heart of an outwardly religious people. Their worship was unacceptable. They were covenant breakers, disregarding God's law, going about to establish their own religion, yet consoling themselves that they were under the protection of Jehovah. And Jeremiah is exposing their cover. Stand in the gate of the Lord's house. The Lord's house in our day is the professing church, identified in gatherings such as we have here this morning. Preachers stand in the gate, as it were, and are given the charge to proclaim the word that comes from the Lord. Hear ye the word of the Lord, is the faithful cry of preachers who represent God, proclaiming the word of the Lord to all who come to worship the Lord. You might argue, but they weren't worshiping the Lord. And I think your argument could be substantiated, but they thought they were. And therefore Jeremiah, the Lord, refers to them as ones who are entering at these gates to worship the Lord. Is that why you came today? To worship the Lord? In this flesh, in this world, like Judah, we are prone to spoil the very things God has given to us to be blessings and to bring joy to Him and to our own hearts. Judah was guilty. We're going to see how they were guilty and how we like them can be guilty. And God was angered. And Jeremiah stood in the gap and he cried, "Amend your ways and your doings." And if Judah listened and repented, the result would have been that they would have continued to dwell in the land. Judgment would have been avoided. I think I said this last week and I say it again, and it won't be the last time I say it. I believe we can glean from these messages of Jeremiah to Judah and to us by application. We can glean this conclusion that God's desire is to bless. But rebellious hearts resist and bring judgment. And I trust that if you're here today and you've been one of those stubborn ones, you've been one of those ones who have followed the imaginations of your own evil heart, you're one that is going backwards, not forward, that you listen carefully and you'll hear. May the words of this prophecy not be prophetic of you. Preacher, you can preach, but they're not going to listen. And I can preach loud. And I can preach passionately. And I can get stirred up. I can call you by name. And I can look at every one of you, even the ones of you who are sleeping. I can slap you with my words. But that will not wake your heart up. And essentially that was the problem with Judah and Israel, is that their hearts were asleep. They were dead. And I know that's the problem with some here today. But some of you have been given life, but you're still sleeping. And you're not moving forward, you're going backwards, and you need to be awakened out of your sleep. Paul wrote to the Ephesian church about that. Awake. He wrote to the Romans about that as well. Awake out of your sleep. May God use His Word today to shake you to alertness in your relationship to God so that your worship will be acceptable to God. I want to apply Jeremiah's message to us today. Keep in mind that worship is not fundamentally about man. Worship is fundamentally about God. It is man surrendering himself to God's way. This is worship. It is man turning from his own designs and his own conclusions, submitting himself to God for the joy of God, for the pleasure of God, for the satisfaction of God. What I'm saying is true worship is about God being pleased, God being joyful, God being satisfied, not you and not me. Now the impact upon the worshiper is real, but it's secondary. It's not primary. And any worship that is guided by that which should be secondary is a worship that's going to be unacceptable, and it needs to be exposed. Worship guided by any other impulse or design other than God will result in not God being joyful, but God being angry. That's the opposite in this text. Angry. I don't like that. Preacher, why do you preach like that? I don't want to misrepresent God to you. And the fact of the matter is, if you come to see God as God is to be seen, it will produce a real, genuine, deep, and lasting joy. And you won't come to the end of your days and be shocked, disappointed, confused, because things didn't work out the way you thought they were going to work out. But if you have a right view of God, and your worship is guided by who He is and what He says in His way and not your way, then you can rest in the fact that God is pleased and God is satisfied, and you will never be ashamed, you will never be disappointed, but you can with confidence go into the presence of God. That's where you ought to want to be. Let me try to give you some thoughts that have come to my mind from this chapter about unacceptable worship. And the first is this. It is unacceptable when you are trusting in the place of worship . I could add a lot of things to that statement there. But when you are placing your confidence, your trust in the place of worship, the location of worship, the trappings of the place of worship, it is unacceptable to God. Now, in the Old Testament, God established a place for Israel. It was designed to represent His presence. Jerusalem, the temple, and Josiah had led an impressive reform to destroy the idolatrous substitutes which had entered into the nation that were established under his father Manasseh. And he had led a reform to repair the broken down temple. People were once again going to church. They were going to the temple by the multitudes. What's the problem then? Here Jeremiah stands in the gate of the temple, and instead of saying, "Welcome all worshipers, welcome, get your bulletin, welcome, welcome, hope you enjoy the entertainment today. Hope you feel good." Jeremiah stands before these religious people who are going to church, and he challenges them. The temple, though established by God, was not sufficient to deliver them. This was a nation in trouble. Egypt breathing down their necks from the south, and Assyria, Babylon from the north. They were being sandwiched between two opposing enemy nations. And no doubt they were coming to the temple in hopes that the temple would be their deliverer. Structures are not saviors. True worship is not guaranteed by location. Jesus said it clearly in John 4:24, God is a spirit, and they that worship Him must worship Him in spirit and in truth, not in this place or that place. Understanding that there was a place in the Old Covenant. There was nothing wrong with the place. The problem was with the heart of the people who were putting their confidence in the place and not the God whose glory was to fill the place. Jeremiah reminds them, hey, this happened once before. Don't you remember your history? You remember that place Shiloh? You can look it up on the internet and you can see this ruins. It's hardly noticeable. These bulges of rocks coming out of the ground and some doorway looking things in them. There's just nothing there. And Jeremiah, standing in the gate of the temple, says, don't you remember Shiloh? Go ye now, verse 12, unto my place which was in Shiloh. God says this. I used to have my place in Shiloh, but something happened then, and it's happening again. And look at what happened to Shiloh. You see, before Jerusalem, Shiloh was the worship center of Israel. The tabernacle was constructed there. The Ark of the Covenant was there. Do you remember the name Eli? And Samuel? All of that happened around in Shiloh. And I just read it this morning. God was very, very angry at the way that they were going about worshiping. You see, Eli's two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, they were fulfilling the lust of their flesh in their temple worship. And you know what God did? And the people loved to have it so. And 30,000 of them were put to death. 30,000 of them. The Philistines came in and did a number on Shiloh. And it's now in total ruins. And what God is saying in these verses, He says, I sent prophets, I spoke to you, but you didn't listen. In verse 14, therefore will I do unto this house, which is called by my name, wherein you trust, that's the point here, you're trusting in a place. And unto the place which I gave to you and to your fathers, as I have done to Shiloh, learn from history. God says, I am not bound to a place. Brethren, we must not think that worship of God is guaranteed by a building. And we must not dress up a place and have our minds satisfied that we have worshiped God because of the place or the impact a place might have upon our mind and emotions. Folks pour bazillions of dollars into dressing up places with all kinds of religious decorations. But those things will never open a person's heart to God and will never bring peace to God. I don't care how good you feel or how mysterious it seems when you go into one of those places. And I've been into them. And you go in and you see, looks like gold dripping from the ceiling. And there is something sort of eerie about them, aren't there? I mean, you go in and it sort of affects you. Kind of like, ooh, man, God must be in this place. Really? Even we can get conditioned to that God is bound to a place. And we begin to worship the place. And miss God. Man's religion is always reduced to places and monuments. Always. Ruth, you've been to India, isn't that true? Remember the pictures from Cambodia? Cambodia? Remember incredible works of men's hands. Do you think God's impressed with that? Look at the universe. Hello? And we build these things and we say, oh, God's going to be impressed? God's going to be bound by the works of our hands? You remember the message Paul preached in Acts 17? He basically said that God is not bound by these things, these works of men's hands. You know you're in trouble when your sense of relationship to God and devotion to Him is controlled by the designated place of gathering for worship. Okay? You know you're in trouble when your sense of relationship to God and devotion to Him is controlled by the designated place of gathering for worship. What would happen if this place would burn to the ground? What would that do to your relationship to God? I love the simplicity of it. We don't have all kinds of trappings. We haven't pumped money into the trappings of this place. That's as it should be. God is not controlled by superstitious religion, which is religion bound to things made with hands. So, unacceptable worship is when we find ourselves being affected, controlled in our attitude and thoughts and emotions toward God by the place. The place of worship. Second, going through the motions of religious worship while your life is unaffected is unacceptable worship. Judah seemed confident of protection against the surrounding enemies because of their religious ritual. Josiah did a good thing, by the way. King Josiah did a good thing in restoring things as it should have been. But it didn't get to the heart of the issue. And so the people hopped on board with the religious rituals. They even seemed to have a chant as they were coming into the temple grounds. The temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord are these. The temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord. Verse 4. And Jeremiah smacks them in the heart and he says, "Trust ye not in lying words, saying, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord are these." I'm going to tell you something. Jeremiah was a bold prophet. I'm preaching to the choir here today. It didn't take a whole lot of boldness for me to preach what I'm preaching. Some of you might not like it, but most of you don't have a problem with it. I would hope to think that God would give me grace to stand and preach. I hope to preach this message March 3rd at the Ney prison in Hondo, some semblance of this message. You can pray for me. I'll need grace there, more so than I do here. But the attitude of Judah seemed to be, so long as they carried out their religious observances, that they were safe from God's judgment, no matter what their lives were like. Verse 10, "And come and stand before me in this house, which is called by my name, and say, we are delivered to do all these abominations." He has just listed probably at least 5, some have said 10 of the commandments that this nation had blatantly broken. And yet they come marching into the temple as if carrying out this religious ritual without a change of life was going to guarantee their protection from Jehovah God, from all the enemy nations. They even found refuge in their sin in the temple. Verse 11, "Is this house which is called by my name become a den, a gathering place of robbers? In your eyes, is this a safe haven for robbers, for thieves? Behold, even I have seen it, saith the Lord." They used religion as a license to sin. Their lives were unaffected in the temple. God was absent from their worship. And brethren, God rejects worship that focuses upon ritual but does not result in change. There is nothing necessarily wrong with ritual. Okay? That's not the problem. The problem was the heart of the people were unchanged in the process of the things that they were doing. They were trusting the rituals without their hearts being affected and their lives being touched. And so, as I read earlier in verses 21 through 26, for sake of time, I'll not read it again. That's where God says, "Put your burnt offerings unto your sacrifices and eat flesh," which was not supposed to be done. But God says, "You might as well eat it because it's doing no good. I don't accept your offerings. I don't accept your worship. Because you're going through the motions, but you're not listening. Your lips are giving service to me, but your life is not." Lying words. Lying words. You're trusting in lying words. Verse 4 and verse 8. And brethren, lying words are any preaching that leaves you comfortable in your sin, that gives you the impression that your religious observance will protect you from judgment as you continue in your sin. You're not safe if you're continuing in your sin. You are not safe. You are not worshiping God if your life is not practically affected in your worship of God. How can you come before holy, holy, holy and not be
touched in your life. I can assure you, you can go through all sorts of ritual and it's sort of compartmentalize this thing of religion. And you get done what you feel you got to get done for your religious conscience sake on Sunday. But what about the other 6 days of the week? It doesn't matter how many crosses you hang, how many verses you post, how many prayers you say, how many services you attend. And the list could go on. If your life is not practically impacted by your worship, you are not worshiping. If your relationship with your neighbor is not changed, you say you love God. Oh, yes. Do you love your neighbor? Do you love your brother? For you see, if you say you love God, whom you have not seen, but you do not love Him, whom you do see, don't kid yourself, you're not worshiping God. And that's really what, isn't that what Jeremiah points out in verse 6? You oppress the stranger. You have no pity. But you kid and help the homeless, they can help themselves. Lowlifes, bums, immigrants, kick them out. In fact, kick them hard so they'll never come back. No kindness in your heart. You're taken care of. That's all that matters, right? Did you choose to be born here? Who placed you? Who gave you the blessings that you've got? I know there are a lot of other ways of looking at the thing, but you get the point here. We're talking about a heart of that is changed in its attitude toward others, the fatherless, the widow, making right judgments and executing right judgment between a man and his neighbor, verse 5. Does your worship affect your attitude toward others? Has your worship brought down the walls of being an American? And don't get me wrong, I'm proud to be an American, that's great. And I don't minimize that. If you understand, I'm not going to chase a rabbit there, but I'm going to tell you something. If I run into somebody that's not the same skin color, doesn't speak the same language, I am not going to kick them to the curb because they're not an American. This is God's world. And our hearts, if we're worshiping God, must be affected by that reality. God, this is your world. And I need a heart for that. You have a heart for this world. Help me to have your heart for this world. Doesn't that make sense? If you're worshiping God, shouldn't that rub off on you? And me? Stealing, murdering, committing adultery, fornication, sexual uncleanness. Whatever form it may be, you say, well, it's just me. I'm just doing it all by myself. Oh, as if God doesn't see it? Verse 11 says, behold, even I have seen it, saith the Lord. I've seen it. You think you've done these things privately in your little den called a temple? I see it. I see what's going on in your mind, God says. I see it all. Does worship affect that in you? Does your worship affect you on the inside? Are there any here today who have professed religion? And you've done your duty, your ritual. It's Sunday. What do you do on Sunday? Go to church on Sunday. Especially in a church where somebody might contact you if you don't go. You know, that's the ritual. That's what you do. Or my parents have made me go. Whatever the case is for you. Are you here today? You've professed religion at some level? Have you said that you worship God? Have you repeated words comparable to the Jewish chant? Maybe you've said, grace, 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 grace. But sin abounds in your life. And you know it. And you know, if today is like every other Sunday, you're going to leave here today and you're going to continue in your sin. Just like Judah. And you know it. Because that's the way it's been in your life. I say to you, if that describes you, your worship is not worship. You may have sung the songs. You may have bowed your head. You may have read along the scriptures. You may have stayed awake through the whole message. But your worship is not worship if you do not leave here changed. Intent on things being different this coming week than they were this last week. Thirdly, and I'll make this as brief as possible, but this will be a last one. Self-satisfying, self-directed worship that is not God's prescribed way of worship is not acceptable to God. Self-satisfying, self-directed, self-centered, self-motivated, self-whatever worship that does not meet God's prescription is not acceptable. And this can happen. I've got two examples here in this chapter. It can happen by ignoring God's order for worship. Look at verses 17 through 20. Seest thou not that what they do in the streets, in the cities of Judah and in the streets of Jerusalem, the children gather wood? I mean, this is a family affair here. The children gather wood, the fathers kindle the fire, and the women knead their dough to make cakes to the Queen of Heaven and to pour out drink offerings unto other gods that they may provoke me to anger. Families engaging in acts of worship, but totally unacceptable. The drink offering, that might be a study in itself, but the drink offering was especially associated in the law with burnt offerings. And you know which came first? Which came first, the burnt offering or the drink offering? The burnt offering. And then the drink offering. And the drink offering wasn't drunk, it was poured out on the ground. Or upon the burnt offering. It's a little confusing at times exactly how it was carried out in different situations. But the burnt offering typified Christ's substitutionary sacrifice for the sinner. That's the burnt offering. That's also the trespass offering and the sin offering and the peace offering. And none of those came after the drink offering. The drink offering was an expression of joy. It was wine poured out on the ground. It was an expression of the worshiper to God, that God had accepted the burnt offering, that God was satisfied, that God was pleased. And here, Jeremiah calls the people on the carpet and says, "You have done disgrace by taking this drink offering, which is to be offered to God, and you've offered it to other gods." And not in association to the burnt offering, but in association to dough, fires, strange fires, making figurines, the dough, probably making emblems of the starry host or something. We don't know exactly what they made. But it was making cakes to the Queen of Heaven, some other god of a neighboring religious thought crept into the minds of Judah. And they poured out drink offerings unto these gods. They attributed to other gods what belonged to Jehovah God alone. And God says, I'm angered by it. You see, God is angered by the self-directed choices of religious worship. And the worshipers themselves are described as being confused in verse 19. Listen, there is no Queen of Heaven. Pope, whoever your name is, there is no Queen of Heaven. There's a church in St. Louis called Mary Queen of Peace. And there's probably a church out there called Mary Queen of Heaven. Because there are those, and this has always been true in the pagan religions, the exaltation of goddesses. And that's probably what you have here. And the Roman Catholic Church has taken that on. There is only one God. And He must be worshipped His way. And there is no mediatrix called Mary. And there is no queen in heaven. There is a king. And His name is Jesus. But there is no queen. God is pleased when we worship in spirit and truth. He is pleased when we pour out before Him a drink offering of joyful praise because we find His Son to be most sufficient for our great needs. True worship brings the soul satisfaction because we know that God is pleased. And when we know that God is pleased, we can sing praises unto our God because we know that He is pleased. And that is our drink offering that is offered up on the heels of the burnt offering which has already been made at Calvary. Our greatest concern must not be our own pleasure. Somebody recently came to visit the church and I was told, they didn't tell me, but I was told, they suggested that we use some canned music, maybe Elvis Presley stuff or something to liven up the service. Or maybe we could bring Bono and you two in here. After all, he's a Christian, isn't he? Or talks about Christian stuff. I mean, wouldn't that help us to liven things up? Isn't it kind of boring just to focus on the truths that God reveals about Himself? Isn't that boring? It is to the flesh, but it's not to the spirit. When you worship in spirit and in truth, you're satisfied that God reveals Himself. I'm going to tell you something. God does not reveal Himself through guitar strokes or drum beats. He just doesn't. Am I against guitars and drums? No, I'm not. But that's not where God reveals Himself. And that's not where worship originates. It does not originate in that. It goes back to the structure stuff. A structure is not a savior. You say, but it makes me feel good. That doesn't mean it's right. I would imagine, and I don't have to imagine, skip over to chapter 26. Those who listened to Jeremiah's message here today did not feel too good about what he said. You say, well, preacher, do you get a kick out of making people feel bad? I really don't. I just told Kenny in our prayer time this morning, Kenny, you know what? It kind of bothers me. It seems like every week I'm bringing these messages and they're pretty heavy. But God's Word is like a hammer, isn't it? And it does chip away things that need to be chipped away. And what remains, hopefully, is more purified. And hopefully, we are brought to a place of truly worshiping. You see, our greatest concern must not be creating a worship atmosphere that connects with this world. Our greatest concern must be that God is truly worshiped. If the world, unregenerate hearts, come into this place and they say, "You guys are boring," I want to ask them, on what grounds do you make that observation? And if it's because we seem very unmotivated by the things that we're saying, if it seems like we don't really believe what we're preaching, if we're not really living what we're saying, then okay, you have grounds to get out of here and never return. But if what we are saying is bringing you face to face with the true and the living God and His appointed Messiah, Jesus Christ, and hopefully someday some of you will be able to say, "Thank you for your faithfulness in preaching the gospel." Well, that's one side. Self-satisfying, self-directed worship that is not God-prescribed, it's not worship. Be careful. Let's all be careful. There's a lot of new stuff on the market today. Okay? I'm not against everything that's new, but be very careful. Remember the old paths. Okay? Be careful. But then there's another thing here. Just quickly. Seeking to satisfy God by extreme means. By extreme means. Your pardon is a gift of love. Your grace alone must save us. Our works will not remove our guilt. The strictest life would fail us. What's the dearest thing to you? Besides your wife, your husband. It's that child of yours, right? Wouldn't it be the greatest act of worship in all the world if you took your child and burnt him or her and said, "God, I think more of you than I do my child. I'm going to burn my child." Surely that will please you. Sounds pretty strict, doesn't it? Sounds pretty extreme, pretty severe. But that's exactly the kind of thing that happens when you go beyond God's law in your attempts to worship God. It leads to extremes, and there are all kinds of religions in the world today who will lead you to extreme measures, even putting people to death unjustly. And even offering your child as a literal sacrifice. Verse 30 and 31, "For the children of Judah have done evil in my sight, saith the Lord. They have set their abomination in the house which is called by my name to pollute it. And they have built the high places of Tophet, which is in the valley of the son of Hinnom, to burn their sons and their daughters in the fire." You can read it back under the reign of Manasseh. He was doing this. He was building these altars and offering his own children upon the altar. And notice what God said. This is interesting, the way it's striking. God says, "Which I commanded them not, neither came it into my heart." Isn't that a strong statement? But why would he be speaking this strongly about this? And this is what came to my mind. Is that this is the kind of thing that comes to the minds and hearts of people who have an idea of God that is not the true and the living God. And you think in your mind, as you are playing upon your own imaginations about what would be the greatest act of worship, and it would be something like this. And isn't it interesting, just like Cain. Remember Cain and Abel? Cain had
Cain had the prettier sacrifice. Cain had the better smelling sacrifice. Cain worked hard at his sacrifice. Cain offered a very, very good sacrifice. It was a fruit bowl that was beautiful, luscious. Why wouldn't God accept it? I guarantee he made sacrifices to put that together. God didn't accept it. And why not? Because it's not what God said he should offer. I'm going to warn you. In your acts of worship, don't go beyond what God has said. I mean, would it be a greater act of worship if you guys had gotten out of your cars and crawled on your knees in here and bloodied your knees and come to your seat and you say, I did that in the name of worship? You know that there are folks who do that kind of thing. I mean, beat yourself. Maybe this morning before you'd come, you should have gone out into the back shed and just wailed yourself senseless, bloodied yourself up, preparing yourself to worship. Why not? Because God didn't say do that, did He? And if you did that, I don't care how devoted you think you were actually acting in an idolatrous way. Disobeying God. Do you know what God expects of us? Obedience. Would you read the chapter later on? Just see how many times. They would not hearken. They would not hearken. They would not hearken. God says, I just want you to do what I say. That's it. Don't go beyond it. Don't make up your own forms of worship. Don't try to create some sort of extreme. We're in an extreme world, our extreme sports, extreme this, extreme that, extreme everything. That's the way humans are. Extremes. And religion will do that. It will lead you to extremes. And you hear some of the language, even some of the people I read after, they use these extreme sort of languages. You know what I'm talking about? And what God says, here's what I'm satisfied with. I'm satisfied when your worship is focused upon my Son, not your extreme measures of devotion. Don't depend upon yourself in your worship. Look to Jesus Christ. What's the answer to unacceptable worship? Amend your ways and your doings. Jesus Christ is the temple of acceptable worship. Go to Him, not a place. Reject worship that is a covering up for sin. If that's what you're doing, if you're covering something up, stop it. Don't use religion to make you feel comfortable in your sin. Amend your ways and your doings refers to the direction of your life, your ways. And doings are the individual instances of your life. Amend them. Change them. Listen, God still expects obedience of His worshipers. The sacrifice of Christ did not remove this expectation of God from His people. It didn't remove. You see, that was one of the problems here back in the Old Covenant days. But we have the sacrifices. We'll just kill a bull, kill a goat, kill a whatever. And then go back to doing whatever we were doing. God says, you might as well eat your sacrifice. It ain't going to do no good. I'll tell you something. The cross of Christ is valueless to you if it hasn't changed you. It hasn't changed you. You see, worship brings us to the cross over and over and over again, recognizing Him as the reason for our forgiveness and seeking in Him power to overcome the practice of sin. Religious rituals, like animal sacrifices of the Old Testament, are a mockery before God if you continue to transgress His commandments. Reject in yourself any supposed worship that doesn't lead to change, and then reject worship that is controlled by self-seeking, self-focused spirit. Look unto Jesus. Anything that is manipulative, anything that's just there to stir up your emotions, to just kind of create an atmosphere, Do you guys realize how many billions of dollars are spent every year on just lighting and sanctuaries? To create an atmosphere for worship. An atmosphere. I get magazines all the time. I get sick of it. I am sick of the religious rituals. Let's guard our hearts against it. They don't help. They hinder. They get your mind off of where your mind should be, and that is upon Christ. And brethren, listen to me. For those who persist, I don't know when this point comes, but I'm telling you, if you persist, you don't listen, you continue in the imaginations of your own heart and your own stubbornness and your own rebellion, and you don't listen, you don't amend your ways, you don't amend your doings, I'm telling you, there is no prayer that is able to effectively stop God's judgment from coming upon you. Verse 16. Don't pray for them. Why did God say don't pray for them? Because in other places, Moses prayed for the nation and God's judgment was stopped. One of the prophets said, I will not sin against you by not praying for you. Remember that? But there comes a place where from God's vantage point, I don't know exactly where that is or when that is, but from God's vantage point, He says, I ain't listening to your prayers. My judgment is set upon that person. Don't be like those to whom Jeremiah preached. Don't use religion as a covering. God knows the truth about you. Would you deal with God about that? I'm telling you, you don't have to satisfy me. I will not stand in the day of judgment as your judge. I'm going to be where you are. I'm going to need a Savior just like you do. Isn't that true? I'm going to be on the same, I'm kind of elevated. I might as well get down there. I don't know what this means. I guess this just means y'all can see me good. I am not elevated in person. I'm right with you. Come clean before God today. Let's stand together and pray.